Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. This is the fifth of our six installments of our very special and highly prestigious year-end awards for the Three Martini Lunch. We've already handed out 12 different crystal martini glasses, and now we head to the categories that the media had. They're sitting on the edge of their seats, Jim. They want to know what the most underreported story, most overreported story, and the best stories are of 2017. So we won't keep them waiting any longer. A lot of nominees out there in all these different categories. So what is your choice for most underreported story of 2017?
If you're on the edge of your seat, sit back. Trust me, it's not worth the wait. It's okay. You can relax. This actually was a really good and important story, and that you kind of alluded to this in one of our other tapings this week. Did anybody notice the Islamic State is gone? That seems like a big deal, right? I mean, they've only been the epitome of evil in the world and setting fire to Jordanian pilots and forcing Yazidi women into sex slavery and conquering places and throwing gays off buildings. They're just like this force of evil. As one of my another conservative blogger put it to me a little while ago, you know, a demonic army is marching across the Middle East and conquering places with names we haven't read since the Bible. You'd think the rise of ISIS was one of the worst developments in the world over the last 5 years. And you know what? They're pretty much out of business as a country or as a functioning state. The Islamic State, you know, you could argue the Islamic State, some would argue they're not really Islamic, and they sure as heck aren't a state anymore. Yeah, they might have, you know, this village here or something like that, but they've driven out of Mosul, driven out of Raqqa, which was kind of their capital. Serious casualties inflicted across the board. Yes, we haven't caught Baghdadi, but as the example of bin Laden tells you, we will get you someday, or you turn out like Mullah Omar. Your death gets reported 2 years later, long after everybody's forgotten about you. This is a fairly significant victory for the administration. The only person who really wrote about this was Ross Douthat over at the New York Times. This is, you know, and you can credit this to Mattis. You can credit this. Certainly a good portion of the credit goes to the Free Syrian Army on the Syrian side and the Iraqi army. After getting their butts handed to them a couple of years ago, they pulled it together. We retrained them. And bit by bit, we managed to retake that territory and liberate those cities, in many cases, bombing the heck out of them from with superior air power, destroying all of those oil refineries that they were using to sell black market oil. I mean, look, the victory over ISIS as a functioning state was, you know, should be one of the biggest and most celebrated and exciting and really good stories of the year. And we've heard really not that much about it. My sneaking suspicion, Greg, is that, well, this reflects well under a Republican president, so we can't talk about that. It's just not an important enough story. Now, we should also point out all the appropriate caveats. This did not, you know, this isn't that Trump came in, snapped his fingers, and everything got better. Yes, there was an acceleration of stuff under Obama, but I think under Mattis, it's definitely taken a much more aggressive approach, arguably one that perhaps is a little more less concerned about civilian casualties. And maybe that's a tough price we've had to pay, but the world is a better place without ISIS in it. Secondly, worth noting, ISIS as a terror group will continue to exist. They can always inspire some lone wolves or known wolves to try to commit some massacre in some urban center. And that really is what bothers us. And so in one sense, the fight against ISIS isn't really gone. But there was this fascinating article in The Atlantic probably about a year or two ago that said, look, what made ISIS different from al-Qaeda and all the other Islamist groups out there that preceded it was that it had territory. It claimed it was reestablishing the caliphate, that it was fulfilling this long foretold prophecy of how the whole world would eventually kneel to their form of Islam. And we're put them out of business. And hey, you know what? It means ISIS isn't that special anymore. We kind of disprove that they're not fulfilling any old ancient prophecy, that they're just like al-Qaeda, they're just like the Taliban. They're just a bunch of guys who go when a U.S. bomb lands on them. And that's it's a good humbling lesson for any would-be Islamists out there. So I think it's a fantastic story. I strongly considered putting this in the best story of the year, but I put a different one for that one, Greg. But that is my nomination for the most underreported story of the year.
It's an excellent choice. And as I mentioned, for a previous award this week. This is a huge story, obviously. Props to Mattis. Props to Trump for letting Mattis and the generals do the job. And obviously our boots on the ground and those in the air who did a heck of a job getting this wrapped up a lot faster than a lot of people expected, including the people in the Obama administration who expected this to take a very long time, much longer than a lot of people initially hoped that it would back when all the beheadings were happening back there in 2014. So I go back to domestic politics for my most underreported story of the year. Jim, I'm guessing at least one of these names will ring a bell for you, but I think if you stopped the average American on the street and asked them who Wendy Wright, Rene Boucher, and James Hodgkinson are, the vast majority of Americans would have no idea. All of them were involved in trying to cause physical harm to Republican members of Congress. Wendy Wright was a constituent, I guess she still is, of David Kustoff, a Tennessee congressman. He had the temerity to vote for the House version of the Obamacare overhaul. We call it a repeal or a reform or a replacement or whatever. And after a town hall, she tried to run him off the road. She was arrested for that. Rene Boucher is the neighbor of Rand Paul. He's the one who assaulted Rand Paul and broke several of his ribs while Rand Paul was minding his own business and mowing his lawn. We still don't have a legitimate explanation for why that happened. And James Hodgkinson is the one who tried to kill dozens of Republicans at the congressional baseball practice in Virginia back in June. Thankfully, due to the heroism of the Capitol Police officers who were there, he was the only one who was killed. Steve Scalise spent months, and I'm sure he's still going through rehab of some sort, trying to live, first of all, for weeks on end. And then he's finally back in Congress. Now, you might say, well, Greg, the congressional baseball game, that got a ton of coverage. Yes, it did. The day it happened, and then the next day when they actually played the game, and then a little bit more when Scalise returned to Capitol Hill. In between, I couldn't tell you if Steve Scalise was still in the hospital. Was he still in intensive care? They just forgot about the story. And then these other two, with Rand Paul, that was barely a one-day story and never really made it above the fold, other than a couple of sites with little blurbs on what happened in Tennessee, Jim. None of Americans would have known about this. So, I mean, you look at Jared Loughner and when he shot Gabby Giffords in Arizona. Obviously, there were more fatalities there, and that tends to be a bigger story. But I don't think you can lurch away from the fact that these people are targeting Republicans doesn't make it as big of a story for people in the mainstream media. James Hodgkinson was an avowed supporter of Bernie Sanders. That doesn't mean Bernie Sanders is to blame here, but you can bet your bottom dollar if all the roles had been reversed and he was an ardent Tea Party guy or a Ted Cruz or Trump guy, we would know exactly who he is and everything about him.
You know, Greg, that is a really great point about that. The baseball shooter was the only name that I recognized. I was aware of the other two events. And it's just very tough to believe that if the shoe had been on the other foot, that we wouldn't be hearing all about the nefarious connections between the shooter and the Republican Party or conservative philosophy. In fact, it was earlier this year that the New York Times erroneously claimed that Jared Loughner, the Tucson shooter, had somehow been inspired by a map she had on her Facebook page that had bullseyes or something like that. And they had to run a rather embarrassing connection about that. So between that and Brian Ross is suddenly inventing, oh, we think this guy might be connected to the Tea Party. Look, there are members of the news media who will instantaneously jump to associate someone with a conservative cause or with a conservative organization. Here we have a guy who was a Bernie Sanders volunteer, and all of these people who are making very explicit, other than maybe the guy who attacked Rand Paul, where he's insisting it was just over gardening disputes. Yeah, okay, whatever, pal. That all of a sudden has nothing to do with politics. It's just random violence. There's no greater, broader lesson to be learned. No one needs to do any soul searching. No one needs to reexamine their hateful rhetoric. It's a ludicrous double standard here. And I could live with either standard. I could live with an argument we should all be a little more careful and less heated in our rhetoric. Or I could live in one in which, like, hey, this is freedom of speech, First Amendment. Anybody can say whatever they want. What I will not tolerate is this imposition of one standard for one party and another standard for another. So great selection there, Greg. The only other thing I can add is that my other nominee for the most underreported story, Greg, was the motive of the Las Vegas shooter.
Yeah, that was on my list, too.
Underreported in the sense that it hasn't been reported. Here we are several months later, and as far as the FBI, law enforcement, and everybody else is concerned, it's like, oh yeah, we have no idea why, worst mass shooting in American history. No idea why he's doing it. Hey, happy holidays, everybody.
All right. So we've done underreported. Let's move on to overreported. Jim, what do you have there?
Sure. I went with the palace intrigue, and I'm making air quotes as I say this, within the White House. Definitely stronger in the first part of the year. It seems like under Kelly, the White House is a slightly calmer, slightly less fractured, slightly less rumor mongering. It just seemed like every day you turn on the morning news and you'd want to hear the theme to Game of Thrones. Dun, 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 dun. Kellyanne is upset with Stephen, who's upset with Prince, who's leaking against, and it's soap opera-ish. And I guess part of it is if you don't feel particularly invested with any of the people in the White House, do you think that the White House is better with Sarah Huckabee standards than with Sean Spicer? I guess maybe a little. As I mentioned, it seems like Kelly is a slightly more disciplined guy than Reince Priebus was. But by and large, the tone of this White House, its priorities and everything else kind of starts with the guy on top and works its way down. And there seemed to be this endless, you know, backstabbing and leaking against each other and maneuvering and undercutting. And it was just, oh, my goodness. You know, you guys are all supposed to be on the same team. How the heck are you going to go out and beat the Democrats if you're always trying to beat each other? Again, it seems like under Kelly, this has been a little more disciplined and a little more focused. But it, you know, the idea that for at least 6 months of this year, you'd wake up either the morning papers or online or something like that, and you'd wonder, who's leaking about who, and try to guess who's you know, faction is rising and whose faction and who's on the way out. We still haven't completely eliminated these kinds of stories. And look, there's a room for these kinds of stories somewhere in the news environment, but it just seemed ludicrously overcovered. And everyone else seemed to find it a lot more fascinating and interesting, and I think consequential than I seem to, Greg.
I'm going to stick with the president in one sense here and just go in general with the Russia investigation. Not that the topic itself was not legitimate and cause for serious discussion at various times this year, but the way that it's gone wall to wall with seemingly less than really significant and sometimes just flat out erroneous information. There have been important flashpoints this year, the firing of Michael Flynn and the reasons for that, the firing of James Comey and the reaction to that, the appointment of the independent counsel, the indictments that we've seen here in the last several weeks, and, you know, digging into the meeting that Trump and Manafort had with the people promising dirt on Hillary Clinton. You know, some of that stuff is very legitimate and grounds for serious discussion, debate, and hey, where does this go from here? But a lot of this other stuff that has popped out is just a bunch of gossip that really hasn't amounted to anything other than taking up airtime and ink. And just in the last couple of weeks, we've talked about stories that have been flung out there without proper vetting, and they've had to be walked back with egg on their face from Brian Ross at ABC talking about Michael Flynn being told during the campaign to make an overture to Russia rather than during the transition. That's very significant. You've got the breathless reporting from CNN over the WikiLeaks email to the president and Donald Trump Jr. They got the date wrong, so it was after those emails had been released, so it didn't matter. There's no collusion, as we can see there. There's the Deutsche Bank issue. So they've gotten several things wrong. There was the investigative unit that CNN had to decimate as a result of getting a story wrong earlier this year as well. Plus, I would say the really petty things that they've spent breaking news coverage on, whether it's how many scoops of ice cream Trump gets to how much he golfs, because they certainly didn't care how much the previous president golfed. So I don't want to necessarily refer to it as Trump derangement syndrome, but there are some symptoms there, Jim, and that gobbled up a lot of unnecessary coverage that could have gone to issues with a lot more substance.
I think my colleague Jonah Goldberg, you know, phrased it well when he says, look, the media is so convinced of how this story ends that they're jumping to the end without actually telling the truth in all the intermediate steps. They're so convinced this is going to end with evidence of Trump's collusion with Russia. They're so convinced this is going to end with impeachment and maybe impeachment of Pence. And maybe we'll get rid of Ryan, and maybe we'll get rid of all the Republicans in Congress, and then they'll all be put to jail because the marshal of the Supreme. I'm sorry, I just turned into Louis Mensch there for a moment. Oh, my goodness. Just got overtaken there. Is this worth investigating? Sure. The main narrative of somehow Trump and Putin are cackling together and you know, planning to hack the election or something like that doesn't shake out and doesn't pan out. Now, is it possible that some folks like Flynn and other folks had violated the law? Yeah, and this is worth investigating. This is worth holding these people accountable. We have seen some people plead guilty, but you're right. This has been turned up to 11 and they broke off the knob since January. Just a lack of perspective and a good example of wish casting. People reporting what they wish the news was instead of what it actually was.
Wow. Well, there has been some good stories this year. I should rephrase that with proper grammar. There have been some good stories this year, but only one can be the best for each of us. Jim, what's the best for you?
You know, Greg, people are going to ask me, how's 2017 been? Look, not everything in the news has been the way I wanted, but a lot of things have gone pretty well, both personally, and I kind of look at the country as a whole, at least in terms of the economy, things have gone pretty darn well. I know my 401k is doing well, and if you don't have one, go get one. Start saving for retirement. This is a good idea in general, but when the market is just on this huge roll, this is really good. The Fed is now raising the projection for U.S. fourth quarter GDP to near 4%. That's the highest in a really long time. CNBC's All-American Economic Survey says, you know, economic optimism is soaring. 41% of the economy improved the next year, which is near a record. Think about how long we've been pessimistic for so long. Now, obviously, it's easier to hit a new record in the Dow Jones Industrial Average when you're already at one, but that means every good day is a new record. The Dow has raised, has gone up more than 5,000 points. That's an amazing number. Oh, by the way, we're getting the tax cut at the end of starting next year. So look, there's a lot of good things going on in the economy. Does this mean every community in America is prospering? No. Is it possible that some sectors are doing a lot better than others? Yes. But look, this is arguably the economic good times. And I think we should take some time to enjoy them and savor them. And let's also point out that I can't help but get the feeling if this was going on under a Democratic president, we'd be hearing a bit more discussion about how great things are and how wonderful the policies coming out of Washington are and how happy we should be because of that. So I hope the economic year has been good for you. And I think for a lot of Americans, it has. And hopefully 2018 will bring more of this.
Yes, just a bit more had it been a Democratic administration. All right, let's move on to my choice. And I'm going to keep it political. I had a couple of other choices. Could have gone in some other different directions, but let's stick with political. If you go back to 2016, and every time there's a controversy, you'll get someone on Twitter saying, this is why Trump won. Of all the issues that I think got people to the polls that didn't necessarily have a lot of trust in Trump per se, it was the vacant U.S. Supreme Court seat. With the death of Justice Scalia and the Republicans refusing to consider Merrick Garland, it all hinged on who won the presidential election. And that's why a lot of people went with Donald Trump as opposed to Hillary Clinton, who told us at a debate she basically wanted a justice that agreed with her on all the hot-button social issues. So shortly after President Trump takes office, he nominates Judge Neil Gorsuch, an appellate court judge, in early February. It's clear right off the bat that Gorsuch has an excellent track record as a judge. His confirmation hearings go pretty swimmingly. The Democrats, of course, obstruct anyway because some of them think that it should still be Merrick Garland. Others just don't want to give anything to Trump. In the end, the Republicans end the filibuster for the Supreme Court nominations, and ultimately Neil Gorsuch is seated. And we don't have a ton of cases that show his philosophy yet, but from what we've seen so far, it's pretty consistent with what we thought we were going to get. And given the delicate balance on the Supreme Court, getting it the justice we thought we were going to get is pretty darn good indeed.
That is a good selection there, Greg. Easy to forget because it's happened kind of in the earlier part of the year. But look, you know, if you're on the right side of the aisle, there have probably been plenty of times that Donald Trump has frustrated you on Twitter or in some of his statements. But look, this is a year for, you know, if you're a conservative, you know, taxes were cut, the individual mandate repealed, Anwar is now opened up for oil drilling, Gorsuch is on the Supreme Court, dozen appellate judges, and a lot of regulations we got rid of. And oh, by the way, ISIS was largely destroyed as a state. We blew up the airports in Syria to teach Assad a lesson about chemical weapons. You know, come to think of it, Greg, this has been a pretty good year.
If Trump didn't have a Twitter account, it would have been a really good year. A lot of distractions from some actual positive developments. So we have three more prestigious awards to give out. Some would say the most prestigious to give out, and those will happen on Friday. Jim, I hope your tux is well-pressed and ready to go tomorrow. We'll see you then.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Friday for our final installment of the 2017 Three Martini Lunch Awards.